Big whoppers. I was trying to think of a time when I lied, and something that came to my mind immediately was when I was little, I was really sick a lot, and I hated swallowing pills. I think that I pretended to gag so that my parents wouldn't give me pills so that I could continue to take the chewables. But then I always ended up getting this one that was really horrible, and so I hid it in this little flower pot, thinking that that would be okay. Well, it was okay. I got better, miraculously, until my parents found them all. There was this flower pot full of these pills that I hadn't taken. And I felt horrible about it, because they're like, those things cost money! How did you get better? So that, for me, that was just a little white lie, or I guess a lot of little white lies that ended up blowing up into this huge, big whopper of a lie. So anyway, I heard on the radio the other day about this study that came out in the Journal of Basic and Applied Psychology, and in the study they had people tell stories, and they After people had a conversation or told a story, it was about 10 minutes long, the person doing the study had the people who were telling or who were talking listen to themselves, and they claimed that they were totally honest in whatever conversation or story that they told. But then when they went back and listened to it, they had all told some kind of lie, and on average it was about 3 lies per minute. So, I know all of you have told a lie sometime, and I want to hear about it tonight. So, if you would like to sign up, we've got a list up here, kind of to the right, left of the stage, whichever way you're looking at it. So, come put your name on the list if you'd like to tell a story tonight. We respectfully ask that if you aren't here to tell a story, or if you're not here to tell a story and you just want to listen, that's absolutely wonderful. But if you're going to have a conversation, there are a couple other places where you can sit, kind of in the greenhouse, or there are tables in the back, just because it takes a lot of... It makes me nervous standing up here telling my little story, and I imagine that that's true for many other people. So we just want to have a friendly environment, an encouraging environment here. So unless if there... Is there a volunteer to tell the first story of the night? No? Oh. I see a hand. Don't be scared. Here. Let me figure out how to work this. Here you go.
Okay. Yeah, that's good.
Is that at your level? Okay.
Yeah,
talk really close to it so we can hear you, okay?
Okay.
All right. And introduce yourself.
I'm Lucy, and this is about a time when I brushed my teeth. I didn't brush my teeth, and nobody caught me. So I was tired of brushing my teeth because I had brushed my teeth for a long, long time, and I was like, I'm sick of this. So I didn't brush my teeth, and I just put toothpaste in my mouth, washed it out, and spit. And then I told my dad I brushed my teeth. He didn't catch me. The day after, my teeth really, really hurt.
And so you know, this microphone moves around, so feel free to adjust it so that... to make your storytelling as comfortable as possible. Are there any other volunteers before we go to our list? Thank you so much, Lucy. Thank you. Any volunteers for the second story of the night? Liars. An audience member just called you all liars. All right, well, the first person on our list here is Eric Taylor. Eric, are you ready to tell your story?
No, it doesn't. Just no. Oh, that That works too. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Eric.
How's it going?
I have a story tonight, kind of, and it's not about a particular lie in general, but kind of lying as a whole. I didn't really lie that much growing up because of the fact that when growing up, I experienced this one punishment, and I remember lying about it, but I forget the particular lie. But the punishment, basically, I remember the punishment fondly. My mother took all the my possessions out of my room and then stored them in her room. So all I had was like a mattress, a couple changes of clothes, and maybe just a couple sheets and stuff. So I remember this fondly, and kind of caught me on this thing of like, I would much rather tell the truth even if it got me in trouble kind of thing, because I knew kind of that being caught, you know, telling the truth was a lot less, you know, punishable. My little brother, however, never perceived this punishment and never really caught on to my thought of thinking. So he was a precocious little thing, and he loved to lie all the time. So he came up with these grand fables, these tall tales, as my mother liked to call them, and he was really cute, and he could get away with it, and I was the ugly one, so I had to get smart, and I did, and yeah, I'm gonna take on the world now. So, but my little brother, okay, so it goes on that nobody really took him seriously. I don't know, like he would always tell these stories, and one day, My little brother decided to go out for the wrestling team. So a bunch of his friends went, and my little brother is, at this point, a freshman in high school, and I think he weighs like 89 pounds. So he was like this little rail kid, like featherweight, and had no wrestling experience whatsoever. But one of these days, he was sparring with the other kids on his team, and he felt like this break in his, or like this little give in his little pinky. So he would came back home, you know, obviously like his pinky was in pain, and he said it was broken. So, and nobody really took him, my mother and her medical expertise was like, could you bend it? So he would bend it for her, and since he could bend it, you know, relatively, it wasn't broken. So, but long story short, we had a we had a foreign exchange student who also got injured, and he had like thought that he had broken something in like his foot, and ended up just spraining it. And while they were there, it's just like, oh, my pinky still hurts or whatever. Mom, can we get an X-ray? Why not? You know, get him to shut up. And found out it was broken. So again, I think last week I said something about breaking a bone as well. So, but so two months in a row. But so like, and I asked him later on too, is that if he had ever heard of the I called him a boy who cried wolf, and he had never heard of the fable, like the boy who cried wolf. So which was just, I don't know, like the boy who always lies, and then nobody takes him seriously. So don't forget your fables. So I guess that's my story.
Thanks, Eric. Any volunteers now? Did that inspire any stories? Craig. Craig's got a story. Then we'll continue with our list.
Okay, I don't think I've ever told this story in quite this way before, so we'll see how this goes. I was applying for this job right after I got out of undergrad, and the job was working for a study abroad program in Kenya. And on the job application, it asked if you could drive stick, if you could drive manual. And I tried to learn how to drive manual just so I could get the job. And I guess this is kind of where it's more like a white lie in that, I mean, I honestly did try. I mean, I had friends take me out in their cars, and, you know, I did my best, but I actually wasn't particularly very good at it. And so off I go to Kenya, and I figure, oh, this is going to be no problem, right? Like, I'll just continue to sort of learn on the job. And when we get there, they said, well, you have to actually get a Kenyan driver's license for the job. So I actually had to go down to downtown Nairobi for a week and take basically their driver's ed. which consisted of every day for like 4 days. The mornings were, they would point to different street signs and say, what is this? And you'd be like, stop. And then you spent the second half of the morning on what they called the Model City, which was basically a painted piece of wood with matchbox cars on it. And they would say, how do you get from point A to point B? And you'd drive your little matchbox car around. And like by the end of the week, I mean, of course, they're running out of like ways to go around a roundabout, right? So they're basically having us do all these like mind teasers. Like, how do you go here without going over there? And it got really weird. Anyways, but the terrifying part was that the afternoons, they would actually take us out and make us drive around Nairobi with like the driving instructor, right? And he had like the little brake on his side and all that good stuff, just like in the U.S. And just like in the U.S., the driving instructors were belligerent and kind of evil. So here I am, like barely knowing how to drive stick, and I'm driving in downtown Nairobi, which if any of you haven't driven around downtown Nairobi, I don't suggest it. It's crazily congested, and everyone there drives crazy, and the lights oftentimes don't work, et cetera, et cetera. So I remember one particularly terrifying experience where I'm driving along, and I guess the strategy of pedestrians is that if there's a little gap between cars, you all just run, and they run in like a huge stream of people that just keeps going and going. So nobody like lets them do this, right? They just keep driving. And so the driving instructor kept saying, just drive. And I was like, oh my God. And he's like, just drive. I'll never run them over. Just drive. Oh my God, I'm going to die. And so basically after a week of doing this, my nerves are totally frayed. I went for like the final driving test. And so the test began at this police station with this police guy coming out and being like, you all look scared. And everyone did look really scared. And he's like, you shouldn't be scared. And he points this guy and he's like, are you scared? And the guy's like, ah. So like, we're being totally intimidated by these police at this station. So I go in there. I take like the oral part of the test. I do fine. I do the Model City, actually. That's part of the test. I had to drive my little matchbox car around. And then I go out for the driving test. And miraculously, I made it and I am here today. So my white lie didn't kill me. But it was terrifying. I don't really suggest lying about driving before you go to Kenya.
Thanks, Greg. I guess we'll divert to our list now. So, Adrian. Oh, one more story. Fred's got a story. Then Adrian. You get a little more time.
Sometimes lying is a integral part of culture. I work in two different places, Turkey and France. And in Turkey, when you ask someone who's helping you get a rent-a-car or fixing something or taking your group somewhere, you ask them if they can do it, and they say, no problem, whether they can or not. And generally they can't, but no matter what you ask them, oh, it's no problem. In France, it's a very different story. In France, for the most part, you ask someone if they can do something for you, and they say, it's impossible. Especially if you're an American trying to do business in France, which I am and was. Now, this story is actually not my story. I'm telling someone else's story of cultural lying. I have a friend in Lyon who runs a teaching kitchen, and she writes a very good food blog. And she had gotten married, and she had moved. She and her husband moved into a new apartment, or actually a house in Lyon. And she had gone to a store, and she had bought curtains for the house. And her in-laws were scheduled to come a week later. All the curtains were finished except for a couple windows in one room. And her in-laws were French, sort of aristocratic French, and she was really worried that they would kind of look at her like she hadn't finished the house, finished the curtains, and it would have been an embarrassment. So she goes back to the store where she had initially bought the curtains, and she walks up to the counter to the guy who had actually sold her the curtains before and said, Monsieur, I have this pattern here which I've gotten here, and I would like to get how many more yards she needed for her project. And the guy says to her, "But it's impossible." And she kind of stepped back, like a little bit concerned, just, "What do you mean it's impossible?" And he says, "We have never had this here." And she says, "Wait a second, I bought this here. I bought this here only 1 month ago." And the man says to her, "Madame, you must be mistaken." At that point, she starts to cry. She's not, this is real, she has not had her in-laws to the new house yet, and she starts to cry and cry and cry. So finally, the guy behind the counter, the fabric counter, says, "Madame, one moment, please." He goes back, the minutes pass. He comes back, and he says, "I do not know how this is possible, but we have enough." That's my story.
Thank you. In case you're just joining us, I don't think I see that many new faces, but this is The Conk. It's live storytelling, true stories, 5 minutes or less, by you audience members. Our theme this week is Who Chopped Down the Cherry Tree, Little White Lies, and Big Whoppers. And the next person on our list is Adrienne.
So I was back home last week at my mom's house in Maine, and she's selling the house, so I had to go through all of my stuff that was at her house. And among the things that I found were a lot of my childhood artwork and school projects and things. And I found this diary that I had when I was like 7 or 8, and it's all about my baby sister, which I don't have a baby sister. And better than that, it's all about how my baby sister is possessed by demons. And she's like, her head is spinning around, and she's like vomiting green goo. And I don't think I'd seen The Exorcist at this point in my life, so I don't know where this stuff was coming from. But more interesting than that, I found a journal that we had to do in school. And the date is 1995, so I was 7, and I think I was in second grade, maybe first grade. And I remember having to write this journal in school, and I remember that we had to do 2 pages every time, and it would really stress me out, because I'd sit there and I'd think, and I wouldn't think that I had 2 pages worth of material to write. And so most of my entries are like one sentence. They're like, "We went to the mall," and then there's a page next to it to draw, and so there's like a drawing of me and my dad like in a building, and that's it. But then there's some entries that go on for like 6 pages, 7 pages, 8 pages, and I'm like, whoa, what are these? Like, did we go on a vacation? You know, are these like big family events? Like, what's going on in these huge entries that 7-year-old me is writing? And they're all these really bizarre stories, and they almost all start with me falling in a hole. They're all, "I was walking home and I fell in a hole." And then from there, it's my adventures in the hole, which usually involve like caves and werewolves and all kinds of things. And there's all these drawings of skeletons and werewolves and whatever. But the best one is actually really short and made me feel kind of inspired. And I read it and I was trying to figure out how to incorporate this sort of lie or idea or thing into my current life. And it's the drawing on the opposite page, because we had to do drawings for the school project, where it's like of this guy who looks like a witch doctor mixed with a superhero. He's got like goggles and a staff and like all these tassels, and he's like falling out of something, and there's all these scribbles. And it just says, "My mom says that you have to go to the doctor." And I say, "No way, I'm not going to go." So I put on my costume and I jump out of the plane. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I actually did. And my mom was like, oh, yeah, I remember your costume. I don't know. But I was thinking about this, and I was like, what kind of person was I when I was seven that, you know, I had no interest in my life, and I just wanted to make up these crazy stories, and, you know, am I still like this? And I was thinking I've been writing a lot of grants recently. and I've realized that it's basically the same process of taking, you know, any experience that I've had and extrapolating upon it until it's, you know, some sort of grand adventure or something. And that's my story.
Thank you, Adrian. That's certainly a more exciting way to think about grant writing. while I'm thinking, we'd also like to thank Satchels and Lightning Salvage for hosting us. Yeah. And thanks to Grow Radio for making it possible. And our next person to thank after she tells her story will be Sally.
All right. So I have a similar story to Adrian's, and I think it's because we both had a similar upbringing of being only children. I think when you're an only child, or if you're the oldest child and you have a bunch of years in between you and your younger sibling, I'm an only child, but I know a lot of older siblings who have this happen, where you like are able to construct this entire world in your head because you have no one else to play with, and you become very good at setting up stories, coming up with stories, and just generally like having this fictional parallel thing happen as your real life is happening. You have this fictional version happening right next to it. So I grew up an only child, and I grew up in a not so fantastic neighborhood, so I didn't really have a whole lot of like, go outside and play with your friends. It was a lot of stay inside because the other kids are gonna steal your scooter again. Like, so I became really good at coming up with stories. And one of the best stories, I think, and it's similar to Adrian's, was that I had come up with an imaginary brother. It wasn't necessarily an older brother or younger brother. It was just an imaginary brother, and his name was Jeffrey, and I blamed him for everything I did wrong. Every bad thing I did in preschool, it wasn't me, it was Jeffrey. If something got knocked over in the house, Jeffrey did it. It became a thing in my family that I would say, Jeffrey does mischief. Jeffrey does mischief. It wasn't me. Jeffrey was doing the mischief. But I had come up with apparently such a convincing like version of Jeffrey and what Jeffrey does, and I would tell my preschool teachers all these things that Jeffrey would do. And one day my mom went in for, you know, parent-teacher conference, and they said, so you have another child named Jeffrey? Why don't we ever see him? Why don't we ever know this, like, how, is he older? Is he younger? What's up with this Jeffrey? And I was like, I only have one kid. I don't know what you're talking about. So eventually, Jeffrey kind of had to go away. But I think even up through like middle school and high school, I still kind of had this like, there's the fictional version, and then there's the real version that actually happened. And what I actually wrote down or like made comics about is like always a slightly fictional version. And I think that's something that keeps coming up as I try to work on autobiographical stuff. So that's it.
Thanks, Sally. In case you missed some of the first stories, or if you just want to listen to it all again, there will be a podcast on Grow Radio. You can check out the website. Also, befriend us on Facebook and get all of the updates you'll ever want. And next up to tell a story is Ellie. Also, if you'd like to tell a story and you haven't put your name on the list yet, I'm sitting right over here. Come see me. We'll add you on.
Hi, everyone. So I was actually telling this story tonight over dinner with my boyfriend and his parents. We were talking about Christmas and the holidays coming up, and I remembered my own childhood experience with Christmas. And I, when I was younger, we only celebrated Hanukkah. My mom had converted from Catholicism when she married my father, so we, you know, I was being raised in a Jewish home. Well, my parents divorced when I was about 7 years old, and it's a difficult experience, but there was this bizarre silver lining when my mom said to my sister and I, "Kids, I've been thinking about something, and if you're not comfortable with it, we won't do it, and we'll hold off." But and I was about, you know, 7, 8 years old, and my sister was like 2, and my mom said, "So, would you be okay if we had just the not religious, but like Christmas tree, Santa Claus side of Christmas?" And my sister and I were like, "Yeah, oh my God, yes." Because I mean, we look, Hanukkah's fine, but I don't know. It didn't have. You know, I mean, and I grew up in New York City, and that's like it turns into Christmas land when you're there, so I always felt a bit left out at home, so we were very excited. However, I had grown up knowing that Santa, and I checked with a parent in the audience to make sure this got the okay, but that I grew up believing Santa was not real. You know, that's what my parents told me, and lots of my friends at school believed in Santa, but I knew the deal. I was like, yeah, no, they didn't lie to me. Like, I know the real deal. But my sister was only 2 or 3 at the time, and my mom and I said, well, wouldn't it be fun if we told Harley that, you know, Santa's real? And so I got really into this idea, and you know, of course it is in itself a lie, but it seemed to be like this really fun, awesome lie that would be really fun, and it was kind of not really a lie, right? Because it's fun. I don't know, but we wanted to make it real. We wanted to give my sister that magic, and to be honest, maybe part of it was she had come into life at this young, you know, where my parents were divorcing and things were kind of tough for her early in life, so we thought, well, let's do this really fun Santa experience every year. And there was one year in particular that I remember really fondly, where my mom and I had you know, put out the cookies and milk, and Harley, of course, fell asleep, and mom and I, you know, ate the cookies and drank the milk, and you know, we went to bed. And my sister and I, strangely enough, both woke up at around like 5:30 in the morning. And I thought it would be kind of fun if I suddenly, so I suddenly said, Harley, what? Do you hear that? What? No, do you hear that? Do you hear those steps? No, wait. No, I heard the step. Yeah. Oh my God, it's Santa. What? Shh, not too loud. You know, and we're in New York City, so inevitably there was a noise. Him, Harley, that was him. Oh my God. Shh, it's gonna be like in the Santa Claus. It's gonna be like in the Santa Claus where he comes down the pipe and a fireplace magically appears in our apartment that has no fireplace. It's gonna be really great. Shh, yeah. Okay. Shh. And it was so fun. And you know, I think I at that point was a bit older. I was about 10. And even though I knew I was just making it up, and the two of us just sat there like squeezing each other, and we were sleeping in the living room that night, and she's like, oh, did you see the red? Did you see the red cape? No, oh, no, shh, shh. You know, and we just kept doing that, and eventually we calmed our excitement, and I don't know, even now I'm, you know, I'm a teacher, I teach third grade, and even though it isn't true, there is some tiny part of me that still wants to believe in that magic, as silly and as untrue as I know it to be. There's this tiny part of me that thinks maybe something did happen that night when we were there, but I don't know. Sometimes lies can be sweet.
Thank you, Ellie. Next up is Michael.
Hi, my name's Mike. This is a story, like when I was a kid, I kind of lied about things just because I lived a very strange life. Like I came to America and I was this new immigrant child, and you know, your story's kind of up for grabs and you're a little unusual, and you can create a whole mythology about you. But you know, I got friends and all these people, and I got to know them, and I kind of wanted to live kind of the lives that they lived. And when I was around 16, like, everybody was getting jobs, and, like, my status as an immigrant legalized enough to where I could get a job. And so there was this movie theater we all hung out at. It was called Shadowwood 16, and it was a small, and it's not an independent movie theater, but it gets all the independent movies and, like, the big blockbuster movies. And we always used to hang around it, and it was like, our favorite hangout spot. And so all of our friends, when we could, got a job at the movie theater, and I went and I applied, and you know, basic process is you apply and then you know you wait. Well, I'm hanging out at the movie theater and I'm talking with my friend, and his manager's there, and I just kind of turn to the manager and say, "Oh yeah, hey, I'm here for a job interview." Yeah, the manager's just like, "Yeah, you had to come in today," and I'm like, "Yeah, yeah," and the guy's just stacking things. He's doing inventory. He has no reason to be dealing with me. But I'm 16, and I'm just like, yeah, hey, yeah, I'm here for an interview. And, yeah, he goes in the back, and he's searching for all these papers and all this stuff, and he comes to me, and he's just like, yeah, so when did you get your call to come in? I was like, oh, it was like 2 days ago, and, you know, they said the paperwork would be fine and everything. He's like, okay, I'll go check. And he spends about 20 minutes to, like, 30 minutes looking for these papers that do not exist. So, you know, he's in the back room, he's searching, and I'm there, I'm talking with my friend, and I'm waiting patiently. And then he's just like, yeah, okay, I can't find them. I'll look later, just come back later. And, you know, I finish talking with my friend, I go home. I get a call about maybe 3 days later from another manager. He's basically setting up an appointment for me to come in. And I've already been to the theater already before and talked to the guy, and he's just like, yeah, I don't know where the paperwork still are. And he's like, okay, come in on this date and I'll have them filled out for you. A different manager has called me on this day to set up the interview where I'm supposed to be interviewed to get this job. But the guy's already filled out the paperwork, and he's just like, show up the next day. And I'm like telling him, yeah, I've got to deal with Mike where, you know, I have to come in and I have to fill out these papers. And he's like, oh, okay, well, if you have that, then yeah, just show up. And then, so I came in, talked with the guy, Mike, and he got the papers, and I'm kind of sitting around, and then I'm talking with the other employees there, and they're like, yeah, man, you're going to get the job. They make people wait for a long time to get the job. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of knew that, because I already set that up. So he basically came, he gave me the paperwork, I had to fill out a bunch of paperwork. And I filled it out in a little area where everyone's basically there to see their movie and they're hanging out. And a few kids from school, like, know me and they see me and they're like, what is he doing? I'm like, oh, he's applying for a job. And they come over and they just wish me luck. And it's like, good luck, man, on your job. And I'm like, okay. So I fill it out, I turn it back in, and he's like, yeah, okay, show up Monday. And I'm, shut up Monday. And that's how I got my job through Lion.
I just have one question for you. Did you ever let anyone know, like anyone at the job know about?
No.
No? No? All right.
I was very convinced a lot.
Okay, I just couldn't live with that curiosity. All right. Next up to tell a story is AJ. AJ? I think I'm reading this right. AJ White?
That's a lie.
Oh, I guess so. All right. Well, if there's no AJ, then the next person on our list is Dave. And if anyone, Dave is the last person on the list, so I'm going to have to start begging. But if you have a story that you'd like to tell, please come see me over here and we'll set you up. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Natalie. So, my very best friend in the whole world is this guy Let's call him Colin. You'll understand why we've got to call him something other than his real name, which I would be happy to call you if I'd had at least one more beer before my name was called. But this guy, he's British, and that doesn't have anything to do with it, except it makes it a more fun story to tell, because I get to do his accent really badly, and it really pisses him off. But he's this great, big, gigantic guy, kind of looks like Sean Connery and Santa Claus had a baby together and then farted on it. But Colin loves three things in the whole world. He's silly passionate about three things in the whole world. One, buying real estate that he cannot afford all over the world. I mean, Colin's got a net worth of about $11 and owns real estate on four continents, you know? So he's like constantly scrabbling to try to make the payment. Well, it's okay, David, because somebody paid me over here, so I can just send it over there and it'll be fine. The second thing he loves in the whole world is gadgets. He's totally into gadgets. This guy never met an integrated circuit he didn't like. iPhones, PDAs, you name it. He's got it, or he wants you to have it, or he wants him to have it because you have it and he wants it. You got the deal, right? The third thing that Colin loves more than anything in the whole world is sleeping with somebody who isn't his wife. That's the third thing that he loves to do. So he's all over the place with, you know, that. So, you know, shagging in various places where he probably shouldn't be doing that, living in a place where people probably know him and wish that he didn't do that or wish that he shouldn't, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he's into all of these things very, very passionately. I mean, there's no talking him out of any of it. He'll take a gadget from somebody like his wife and he'll say, no, it doesn't work that way, Cleo. Let me show you how to log into Skype. Here, we'll do it with mine. And he's got her all logged in on her laptop and so forth, and he's just crazy about it. And you just stand back and watch. The real estate, the good thing about that is it's like they say about a boat. The best way to own a boat is to know somebody who owns a boat. So I get the benefit out of the fact that he's got all this real estate all over the place, especially this lovely place up in North Carolina. So we go up to North Carolina. He says, I tell you what, David, we'll split the driving. You drive the first half. I'll take the second half because I know where to go. We'll split the driving. And then he falls dead asleep in the back. And you could set a cherry bomb off back there. And I end up driving the whole way. But it's fun. We enjoy it. So it's not that long ago, it's about a year and a half ago, and Colin's been involved on the side with this woman who's not his wife, you know, big, heavy, southern accent husband, you know, the kind of guy who can tell you two sentences in a row without touching his lips together, you know, this husband, hey, what the hell you think you're doing kind of thing, you know what I mean? So he's seeing her, and, you know, devil may care about that, and then he goes down to his place in Costa Rica. He's got this big sprawling place in Costa Rica, except he goes with his wife, right? I mean, that makes sense in a way because they own all this real estate together. So she's sitting in one corner of this big open room watching a movie, and he's in another corner of the room really thinking how much fun it would be to be, you know, hanging around with this other gal on the side. So he finally pulls out his very clever smartphone, and he composes this very explicit message in which he says some very explicit things, which I won't even do with the bad British accent, and then he presses send. And the instant he does that, he hears a little ping sound from the other corner of the room. And he looks over, and on his wife's laptop, where the actors should be, there is instead this big, brightly colored pop-up box that says, your Skype message has just been sent successfully, because he never logged himself out again. So now she opens this thing up and reads this whole deal and finds out about the whole thing, and he spends the next year trying to wriggle out of all of this, which is, of course, what he wanted all along, presumably. But the moral of the story is, if you're going to be into two of those things, that's fine, but pick two. It's the gadgets, being with somebody who isn't your wife, real estate that you can't afford, pick two.
Thanks, Dave. Is there anyone else who would like to tell a story about a little white lie or a big whopper or cutting down a cherry tree? Okay, Oh, I see a hand. Thank you. Introduce yourself when you get up here, since I don't have your name.
Hi, I'm Brian. I studied religion in my undergraduate degree, which is why I'm so fabulously wealthy today. And before I really get into the story, what I do want to say is that that this story it taught me about how easy it is to make up things when talking about religion. It also, that's probably the extent of what it taught me. but the other thing that I do want to preface with is that I thoroughly abuse the class that I was taking, which was called Chinese medicine. It was the way of Qigong, and we were looking into various types of treatment in Chinese medicine that include, you know, acupuncture, herbalism, and one of which is feng shui. And I was assigned to write a paper on feng shui. And the thing is, I got to the night before and hadn't yet done anything that would resembled at all changing a space to change the flow of energy, because that's what feng shui does, is that it changes the flow of energy in a physical space, so that more healthy energy comes in, unhealthy energy leaves. It's a wonderful thing, and I actually heartily encourage everyone to look into it. It's great. I took it more seriously later. So there was this paper that I had to write, and it was me and my roommate, and my roommate really liked to smoke, really liked to eat sandwiches. Do you understand what I mean when I say he really liked to eat sandwiches? And so he was eating sandwiches this night, and I was trying to type a paper, and I did a fair job. Had I done it actually a month before, it would have been a great experiment, because I mapped out the room, and then I rearranged it according to the premises that the research gave me, and by this time it was about, you know, 1 a.m. And so I changed the whole flow, and then I started attributing things that had happened to my roommate and I to this change that I hadn't made. And the great thing about it is, as I was saying it aloud and checking in with him, he was so credulous. And I would be like, well, you know, we had both gotten excellent grades on a creative writing piece, you know, 2 weeks ago. And, you know, there's this teaching that a large amount of clear space in front of you allows a clarity of thinking. And so I put that in the paper, and sure enough, I talked about draining negative energy out of the room by careful placement of trash receptacles. This is also part of feng shui. But the nice thing is that, you know, as he was there eating his sandwiches, he was like, yeah, that makes sense. And it just went back and forth between us, and it was so nice to have someone who would believe everything I said, even though he actively knew that I hadn't done any of these things. So it did teach me, in retrospect, one, that this is the other thing it taught me that I had forgotten previously, that eating sandwiches increases credulity. But the other is indeed that, you know, looking at religion, it's very easy to attribute things to things that aren't there. It makes the search for truth that much harder. Sadly, it also makes the search for falsity that much easier, because I ended up getting an A on the paper. And that is my story of my lie.
Thank you. While someone out there is getting up the courage to tell the next story, I'd just like to thank Satchel's Lightning Salvage and Grow Radio again. If you'd like to listen to the podcast, that'll be up in a couple days, or it'll be broadcast on Grow Radio on, I want to say, the 27th, but I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact date. I'll get back to you on that. A week from Saturday. All right. Now, is there anyone who'd like to tell the next story? Oh, Jordan. The 24th. It'll be broadcast on the 24th. Jordan, and Jordan's got a story for us.
Just so you guys know, we sell cookies here at Lightning Salvage now. We got a nice little display rack.
Satchel wanted you to know about them, yeah. They're good. They're very good. Ruthie's, no, just, no, not sandwiches. Oh, my. So, lies are really interesting things. As a young kid, I used to lie a lot, especially to my parents, you know, about where I'm going, what I was doing, girls I liked. And I think a lot of people have that kind of, for a while I had this mantra that lying didn't count if it was to your parents. You know, that didn't count as lying because you could just lie to them and then you can go somewhere and have fun and they wouldn't, you know, be able to get in your way. And at one point my parents caught me in a lie really badly, which is probably a different sort of story, but it made my dad cry. And so that was where I stopped lying to my parents altogether. Like, I realized there are such things as hurtful lies and it can, you know, you can hurt your parents. But another thing that my dad did for me, he taught me how to play Dungeons & Dragons, which is a really fun game that I'm not at all ashamed of playing as an adult. It's pretty awesome. And I've been doing, you know, I don't know, most people may not know how the game works, but suffice it to say, one person is in charge of telling a story, and the other people play characters in the story. And so I was always the one who had to tell the story because nobody else would want to. And so I got really good at just telling stories off the top of my head. I would just, you know, the dragon would fart and it caused a giant explosion and then it revealed the hidden treasure that the dwarves were keeping and, you know, you would just go on and on. And as a kid, you know, there was lots of explosions and farting and dragons because that's what kids like. And as an adult, you have to get a little sneakier. You have to make things a little more interesting. And this is still not really, like, I'm not really going to tell a story about Dungeons and Dragons either. I just want to talk about how these are stories and they're not real, and so in a sense they're a lie. But they're not, because they're stories. They're okay to tell and you can play around with them and everybody's sort of playing pretend. But then I started to work at a place that took care of bats. It was like a small private zoo that just had bats. And we would get interns on occasion, and then I would tell them little lies about animals and little knowledge, little nuggets of knowledge about animals. We had a sugar glider, which is a kind of flying squirrel. It's a marsupial flying squirrel. You know, it's got the little wing, you know, it's like a kite, you know, when it flies, or it doesn't really fly, it just glides. And the intern knew this, and we had these because we wanted to demonstrate to kids that would visit, you know, these animals don't fly, they glide, and the bats, they really fly. So she knew this. She knew a little bit about sugar gliders, but I told her about this little-known fact about sugar gliders, that they live in Siberia, is really where they come from, which is not true at all. And they migrate across the Bering Strait into Canada and Alaska. They ride the thermals. And they, you know, like, masses of them ride the thermals across the Bering Sea, and which is also not true at all. But I had her going for the whole day. It was really funny. And eventually, like, I can't let the story go on too long. Like, a whole day was about the length I could keep it before I started to feel bad because she really thought it was true. And I had to tell her, you know, okay, well, this is not really, you know, what was going on. But I guess the story that was the most interesting, and it's hard to, how do I get from there, from here? Because this was kind of, well, it was a story I would tell people. I went to North Carolina to learn how to blacksmith. There was a little blacksmithing class I took up there, which was a lot of fun. And in it, we went out to this junkyard as a test. We were going out there to test different kinds of metal. You find metal a lot and use it as a blacksmith. And so this was sort of, we went out there to check out some different metals, see if we could identify them properly and all of that. And it was really nice. It was like backwoods, you know, Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina. And this, like, you know, this salty old dog of a guy was running this junkyard. And I had made a really good friend in the blacksmithing class. He and I got along really well. We would talk and we would joke around. And walking around, like, it's up on the side of a mountain that's been maybe flattened. I don't know if they mined there, because we also visited an old mine at one point. But anyway, the area had been flattened, but there was still a lot of rocks, and it was very much like a bare mountain. There weren't too many trees. Anyway, so my buddy and I, we kind of get off by ourselves, and we're checking out. There's a lot of cool old tractors and, you know, like metal bits and kitchen sinks and whatever else. And two of the things we came across, one was this really deep hole. And it was kind of off to the side, but there wasn't anything stopping you from getting near it. You know, I mean, this was not that kind of a place. Children didn't go here, and, you know, so there was this hole, and we had thrown a rock down it and hadn't heard it hit. And we were like, well, it obviously has a bottom. We just didn't hear it for whatever reason. And I guess we did find three things, really. The other thing we found was a goat. This guy had a goat that was hanging out and was actually chewing on some wire. And I didn't really think goats did that, but apparently they do. So he was chewing on some wire, and we tried to stop him, and he didn't like that very much. He was a bit of an ornery goat. And he was kind of near the hole, but he was far enough away, and he was dealing with his wire, so it was fine. And we threw the rock anyway, and didn't hear bottom, and we were like, there's got to be something down there. We're just not hearing it right. So we searched around, and we found I don't know cars very well, but it was some kind of piece of a car that's rough, maybe a carburetor or some kind of, it was almost square, and it was heavy. And, you know, I picked that up, some tubes came out of it, I picked that up and I threw it down in there, and we still didn't hear anything. And I was like, no, this is not right. Like, there's got to be, maybe there's water or moss, or we didn't know. And so we cast about one final time, and this is the part I do know about a car. We found a transmission laying nearby, which, if you don't know what a car is, it's you know what a car is, but parts of cars, it's a really big piece. It takes like a lot of effort to shift and move, and it was quite large. And so he and I picked it up and we heaved it into the hole, and we looked down, and there's a moment where there's just silence, and then we hear the goat scream in terror, and we look behind us, and the goat is charging right at us, or at least that's what I'm thinking at that moment. And I dive out of the way, and down the hole goes the goat. And I'm like, oh my God, why did the goat try to kill us? Why did it, you know, what is going on here? And we're kind of freaking out, and so we just run back to the van. We run back to the van, and we're like, we're just ready to go now. We're not going to talk. We're going to be fine. It's okay. And sure enough, this salty old, like, crusty, bearded dude comes walking up, and he's like, you guys seen my goat? And we were like, you know, no. And he's like, I had it tied to my transmission. And
the least awful thing about this story altogether is that in itself it is a lie. It's just a story I was telling. It's not true at all. Yeah. It was told to me by the salty junkyard guy, though. So that was real. Okay, who's gonna top that?
anyone? You don't have to talk to me. Oh, Lucy, have you got another story? Okay. All right, we'll go to Lucy.
This one's about my report card. So once, when I was in second grade, or third grade, I was really mad at my teacher, and I went home from dad and I got a bad grade on my report card. And so I left my yellow folder at school, and I claimed that I forgot it when I got home. And so I kept on saying, oh, I forgot it, oh, I forgot it, oh, I forgot it, oh, I forgot it. Until finally, I accidentally brought it home because I forgot about my report card. And my mom got mad at me. And I'm in trouble.
Thanks, Lucy. I don't think you're the only one who got in trouble for something like that. Alright, does anybody else have a story about a little white lie or a big whopper? Okay. Alright.
Okay, I'm Jessica. I've been sitting over there wondering what the last big lie I saying was that I was still maintaining. It took a while to actually remember. I heard about the tiny bird and then lying right now. What about when one of your parents urges you to lie to others? So, to me, that's very interesting. I'm an obvious traveler, but my mom is not a serious student in my life to travel. So, I was talking to my dad, who, you know, never wants to be ratted out if he doesn't really know. Which, you know, I don't know. So, I spent China, 2.5 weeks in China, and that was something we read out, and I was like, oh, yeah. That's just keeping a really big lie from my mom. So during that, for 2.5 weeks in China, they're trying to maintain that lie without a phone. It's very interesting. I was trying to get on Google from China. There's lots of big email on the time shift. So I'm going to figure it out for myself. We'll see.
Thanks, Jessica. Anyone else willing to share their lie? Or a friend's lie. It doesn't have to be your own lie. Alright. We've still got about 45 minutes until left, or maybe 30. So I'm going to be right over here. If you get up the courage to tell a story, come tell me. If one of your friends at your table turns to you and starts to tell a story about a lie that they told, go and send them up. Because everyone wants to hear it, not just your table. Alright, so, little intermission here. Oh, Michael's got another story.
Hi, I'm Mark again. I just remember the story from your report card story. Yeah, I was young. And just started middle school and like up in the other country. I was considered more or less a remedial student. It was basically because I had a hard time adjusting and doing so much new stuff. And I was also really, really lazy. Like, if I had an excuse not to do it, I wouldn't do it. So I'd always get not only the report card with a badge, but I would also the report card would come with a letter. A letter that I had to give to my parents, explaining that, you know, I'm not really doing that well in school. And of course, I'm not sure why you didn't just nail the letter to my house and gave it to me to give to my parents. That letter never made it out of my backpack. Not once. And, you know, I'd go home, never show my parents the report cards. They didn't know what a report card is. Yeah. I'd go back to school and then they'd ask, and there's always like a thing for my report card. It had to be signed by my parents. And then they'd be like, okay, you have your report card signed. I'm like, no, my parents kept it. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, give them the letter. I'm like, yeah, fine. And of course, you know, there's no other repercussion for them to do. I'm like, okay, you're lying, kid. And it's like, you know that. They just want to take my word for it. Yeah, no, they have it. I don't have it. And this went on for a really, really long time. Slowly figured out what the phone number of my house was, and eventually called my parents.
told you you weren't the only one. Alright, did anyone put up some courage there in that story or anything? To tell their story? Alright. Justine?
I kind of promised myself I would do this the last time we were two on stage. You would have all remembered it. Anyway, this reminded me of the poor car story now, because I tried the same thing with my mother. I had miraculously forgotten my report card, but not because I was afraid to show it to her, which I was, but a year before I'd gotten straight A's, and she told me it didn't count because I hadn't worked hard enough. So, thank you. So at this point, you know, I had become a fourth grade realist. You know, I kind of thought, you know, God, well, what's the point? Oh, sorry, hold on a second. You know, what's the point? Oh, this is from Colin. I have to check this one. Sorry, it's your reference. Keep up with me. I'm going through all my A material. I've got very little left. Last month we were here, and I'm not even getting to my story, because I figure I've got all kinds of time. I don't feel as nervous this time, this is great. Anyway, last time, there was a woman up here talking about how there was someone back there talking last time, and how she was so proud of Gainesville because no one said anything to this person to shut up. You know, they thought it would be rude, and you know, people living up there, but I don't know, if that drunk bitch was behind me talking, I'd have told her to shut up. So, I'm sorry, for the foul language, I did have a big story about lies. They all happened in South America, and the big white lie, the little white lie, your mind, the really big lie that caused the problem. We were conned into leaving South Korea. I was offered a job in South Korea that paid double the job in Chile, and required half as much work. But I had understood that this job in Chile was opened by this wonderful entrepreneur who was actually helping poor Chilean children learn English so they could get a leg up in the world. And I thought, this is fabulous. You know, this is, so I took a 50% pay cut, it's going to be twice the work, and go down to Chile and help underprivileged South American children get a leg up. I think someone knows where this is going. Anyway, so I get down to Chile, and I'm sitting in the class, and every kid in the class has a cell phone and an iPod, and they're all nicer than mine. So I'm realizing that, okay, this is like lie number one, is that these are the richest kids in Concepcion, not the poorest kids in Concepcion. And I have given up, double the pay, half the work, and national health care, which brings me to another major lie. Anyone who tells you national health care doesn't work is lying to you. And I know this, thank you, for a fact. Not because I read it, and not because I heard left wing, someone tell me this. I lived through it. National health care freaking rules. And anyone who tells you otherwise is filling your head with nothing but lies and propaganda. And I don't care if you're out there saying wrong, you're wrong, because I had national health care. Have you? Well, I haven't even gotten my story yet. So anyway, in South America, back to the rich children, and I slowly realized that I was actually kind of being persecuted by the owner of this school, who, as it turns out, was crazy. And he had all these weird fictions built up, and where I thought initially that they were all lies, it turned out that he was delusional. And the big shining moment in this, he's telling me about what a great rapport he has with the children. Well, the problem is, there's nothing wrong with being old, but he looked like Skeletor. He had this sort of like really hollow, sunken, frightening skeletal face. And he would be talking to one of the children, I'll never forget this, from behind her, and she's sitting there, looking as if he actually not only was Skeletor, but did she just see his picture on like the sexual predator page of the paper? So it was sort of this whole chilly experience was like falling down around me. And I get there and realize that they don't have national health care. What they have because he promised me again at the time I was recovering from cancer. They had something else. And what they had was health care that forces you to actually buy insurance. And it didn't work. It was actually an absolute disaster. And people there would get sick and not go for help because they couldn't afford it. So everything that got me there was a lie. These children were not poor. They were not underprivileged. I suddenly had no health care. And I realized that the guy who owned the place was batshit crazy. And he actually had said he was going to have to fire me and send me home. And I thought, fine, thank God, I'll go to Korea. You know, make more money, the heck with this. So I started making plans to leave. Well, his reason for getting rid of me was that the kids didn't like me. Well, as it turns out, as a friend of the plans to leave, he realized that that wasn't going to work for me because I was actually the favorite teacher in the school in this situation, and he really didn't want me to go. So he came to my partner at the time and said, I hear this just kid is leaving. Why is she leaving? And my ex said, because you said she had to go. You said you wanted to fire her. And he said, I never said that. And I thought, okay, this is getting weird. Now I'm realizing just how incredibly delusional this individual is. It just happened that like the day before the crap hit the fan, I had actually been invited to dinner by my student's fathers, 12-year-old Daniel, and his father had invited me to dinner with him. And the very next day, my partner came up to me and said, we have a problem. We've been here for almost 3 months, and we haven't filed any of our paperwork. We were working as illegal immigrants in South America. So here's a nice twist for you. And I'm thinking, how do you get out of South America, pass through visa, as an illegal immigrant? You're screwed, right? So I said, fine, this is good. We're just going to walk out of here, and we're just going to leave in the middle of the day. And my partner said, now is the gift, now. We're just going to go. So I got up in the middle of my class of seniors, and I announced, okay, we're leaving, so you can tell Gregory and Miss Magda to stick it up their asses. So I made my big bold entrance and I marched out of that room with my head held high, went all the way downstairs and realized I was left my friends in the dark. So I do, you know, the kind of like big band bite kind of maneuver where you kind of just have to humbly walk through and pick up your purse. You make this glorious entrance and then you walk out and do an ass of yourself. Well, I didn't know what to do. So I thought, oh, okay, wait, I'm screwed now. So I started writing a letter for Diego's father really quickly, saying, I know you don't know me, blah, 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 but we've just been, we just left our jobs and we don't really know what to do. If you want to have dinner with me, now is the time. So I then get to my apartment and I realize that not only am I now jobless in South America, I'm also homeless. Because the school owned the apartment that we lived in. So this whole thing is going to hell really, really quickly. And then Diego's father shows up, and he's sitting in the living room with something in his hand, and he's rolling it over and over in his hand, and he's crying. And I don't know why Diego's father is weeping. You know, this very sophisticated college professor, and he's rolling over his hand. And what he says to me is, I agreed to help you because my son Diego, in 12 years of school, has only talked about two teachers and you're one of them. And so, because of that, and my son's asking, I'm going to help you guys get out of the country. And he opened up his hand and he had a little dial in his hand. I had been teaching the children to make their own board games, and Diego had made a little dial. And before him, the father said, Diego wanted you to help us. And I'm crying because my son is hopeless with his hands, and this is the first beautiful thing he's ever made. So he gave it to me, and I bought it with me. The game's so I couldn't just stick it in my purse. Anyway, so I then find out that Jorge is a Freemason. Of course, we're going to be Freemasons involved. Anyway, and my friend Jorge, the Freemason, actually knew the head of Interpol in Chile. No, this is true. I'm not making this up. This is all true. I don't lie, by the way. Not because it's beneath me, but because I suck at it. Nothing's beneath me. If I was good at lying, I'd lie all the time. So just don't look at me like, oh, I'm some sort of holy person that don't lie. I just can't do it well. So anyway, we were told by Diego's father, you know, Jorge, that he's going to help us get out of this. He's his friend with Interpol. So we got all of our paperwork from the school, the paperwork they did have. And here's what the lies have been really weird. It said that my partner was a corporation and that I was a 98-year-old woman. So the lies are building and building and building. And Diego is realizing that his son is in a school that's being run by crazy people. An interesting story happened just before we left the building the first day. When I gave Diego the note, he of course announced to the all the children that they were using. So all the kids ran out and followed us in the hall and were surrounding us, like gangs of them. And then word spread like wildfire and all the classrooms emptied. And they were completely surrounded by hundreds of Chilean children saying, don't leave, you can't go, don't leave. And one of them said, we will have a revolution. And considering that there's still, you know, pro-Pinochet graffiti all over Concepcion, Chile, this actually means something to them, you know? So I start having dinner regularly with Jorge, which usually involves me drinking a lot of whiskey sour and getting Diego in trouble and then laughing about it because the father never catches on, but Diego knows what's going on. So the basic end of the story really is that Jorge hides us. He takes us out of that apartment and he hides us in a hostel. And then he takes us out of a hostel and he hides us in a hotel. Meanwhile, he's, you know, talking to his wife, who also happens to be a tax attorney. So she now has in her possession all these fraudulent tax documents from the school who had hired us with a bunch of lies and also made us illegal immigrants. So suddenly, there's piles of paperwork against the school in Concepcion. And ultimately, I thought, good, we're good again. So once we're out of here, Diego's father, Jorge, is connected, and he's going to nail these people. So what happens is that Jorge then finds calls the head of Interpol and starts to tell him what's going on. And the head of Interpol says, wait, you can't tell me anymore, or I'll have to arrest them. But here's what you did. So he gave Jorge the whole list of things we had to do. And Jorge had to drive us all over Concepcion, trying to get us out. And while this sounds like this exciting, incredible adventure, what it really is it's like 11 days waiting in an airport. It's the most stressful and miserable and long 11 days of my entire life. You know, because while there's a few moments of adventure and running and hiding, the rest of it is pacing in a hotel room or a hospital, wondering how the hell you're going to get out of the country. So ultimately, Jorge pulled all these things from this man's car, and he said, okay, this is the story you have to tell. And he runs through this whole story of what I have to tell. That I have these two different official officers in a country in which I'm working as an illegal immigrant. And I said, Jorge, I can't lie, I can't do this, I can't tell these stories. And Jorge took me and said, you have to. And he followed it.
Thanks for coming. Just so I got some time left, if anyone would like to tell a story about one of their lives or a lie that they were involved in, a little white one or a big whopper. Okay, well, we can go into our little intermission. If anyone, we've got one more. It's okay.
Now this is the worst story. This is the worst story. I have a kid's sister who's 17 months younger than me, and I've hated her since she was born. I'm not trying to rationalize misogyny, I'm just trying to, here's the thing. In my family, we have a recessive trait where I was born without fingernails. Well, they call it without fingernails, we have fingernails. But they're like these little scrunchy, like, when we go to job interviews, people think we did this to ourselves, that we did that. We also don't have eyebrows. Like, these glasses are fake. I don't need glasses. I'm wearing glasses because it gives me facial features in my mind. Like, I feel like I don't have dimples or eyebrows. Don't take a picture of me without glasses, Bill. So, my kid's sister is born, and she's born with normal fingernails and, like, the thickest eyebrows. Y'all can't imagine being, like, a year and a half old and having an eyebrow fetish or being like, oh, you people with eyebrows, y'all know what it's really like to live. Anyway. The first time I ever crawled up on her crib to try to be her friend, she, like, pushed me down. I had nightmares about her. Anyway, she grows up to be conventionally beautiful and, like, Barbie attractive. And, like, we would go to this Baptist church in upstate South Carolina. And this is really what it was like when we walked into church. She would walk in and they'd be like, oh, my God, you're so beautiful. And I'd be coming in behind her, like, and you, there you are. You can't say you don't exist. Anyway, so I got it. Anyway, she looked up to me because I was older than her, and she trusted me a lot. And people kept telling me that, which went to my head. People kept saying, she would do anything you say. She looks up to you so much, she would do anything you say. And I think I was probably a sociopath at a very young age. And, like, really, she would do anything I said? So my genius plan, we lived in a house that had a very high brick stairwell, was to drag her Barbie Big Wheel to the top of the stairwell and lie to her about these secret rules about the only way to get a Barbie stairwell down. I'm going to lose some of you. So she's like, she would do anything that I said. And I said, there's this rule that the only way to get a Barbie Big Wheel down from the stairwell is to ride it. That's what I heard. That's the rule. And she's like, really, big brother? I remember the, like, Little House on the Prairie-ass innocent look that she gave me when she said, you promise the only way I can get my scooter down the stairs is to ride it. I said, yes. I'm sorry. Sorry. Isn't the theme lying? Anyway. Liberal crowd. My little sister, my beautiful kid sister, got on that scooter and, like, she was flipping by, like, step two. Like, I watched her sad, beautiful JonBenet Ramsey body just tumble all the way down to the bottom. It was horrible. Like, I've never felt, I was like, I'm a bad brother slash person slash entity. Anyway. But she got revenge. And here's, our house had a back porch that was the high steps that I did. Tried to murder my sister down. We had a front porch that had a yellow jacket bush, and my sister came up with a genius plan. My mom's like putting all these ice packs on my sister. Like, why did you do this to your sister? What's wrong with you? I was like, well, I don't have fingernails or eyebrows. Anyway, for some reason I had a moral quotient to me. So, what was the point? Oh, yeah. So I'm out in the front yard because I don't want to go in the house because my sister was laid up on the couch being a drama queen about, oh, look what you did to me. Everybody pay me attention. I'm worried. I mean, I'm a bad person. She was wounded. And so I'm out in the front yard, but my sister comes up with the most genius plan ever. When my mom is not looking, she goes, hey, William, I left one of my flip-flops on the front porch. Will you go get it for me? And the front porch is where the yellow jacket bush is. And I go, well, yeah, the least I could do is go get her flip-flop. I mean, it's on the front porch. I don't have access to that porch. I don't want to go in the house. This seems doable. But my sister comes up. She goes, oh. She hobbles up to the screen door. And she's holding the flip-flop. And this is kind of for those of you who watch Breaking Bad, this is kind of a Gus moment or something. Where I went, she has one of the flip-flops. Where's the other flip-flop? And I realize she has thrown it into the yellow jacket bush. And then she latches the screen door and stands there staring at me while the bees just swarm. It is, like, hideous. Like, and then she laughs as they sting because mom was like, oh, mom was doing something. What did that mom do? Mom was heating up soup. And anyway, I'm stung. So then she had, luckily we had two couches, matching paisley couches, I remember. And so my kid sister is laying on one, covered in ice packs, and I'm laying on the other, eventually covered in ice packs, on account of all the yellow jackets thing. Well, I'm just kind of, they're going like, you two just can't get along, blah, blah, blah. This ain't, this isn't the America Jimmy Carter imagined or whatever. And then, the heartwarming ending is that she now is crazy rich on kind of being conventionally attractive. She married a dude who edits reality TV. He edits like Hell's Kitchen and Jersey Shore. He sits there like scrambling the parts that no one wants to see. And because I am a community college teacher in Gainesville, Florida, several of you are. I'm going to make eye contact with several of you. Sometimes the bills aren't. Which, anyway, she sends me money. But there's this little sad part of me that goes like, hell yeah, money from my rich pretty sister. And before I'm on the plane, there's no jackets in my bitch.
Two more stories. Is there anyone else who'd like to get in a story about their lives? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and tell you the theme. We've got our theme for next month. Next month's conch will be on December 11th, and the theme will be Holiday Affective Disorder, the Ecstasy and the Agony. So, start thinking now. One last chance to get in your story. Alright. One last thank you to Sackle, Lightning Salvage, and Grow Radio. If you missed any of the stories and you'd like to catch them, the podcast will be available pretty soon. And the broadcast will be on November 24th at 7 p.m. Grow Radio has apparently a blog on WordPress that I didn't know about. Also, there's a Twitter, Facebook, the Conch also has a Facebook site, so friend us for all the updates. And hope to see you next month. Thanks so much, everyone.